This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
The people speaking tonight, three of the four of us are all radiologists and one is an obstetrician gynecologist. And we're going to talk about very specific fields in radiology. And I'm glad that you're interested in this. Mostly radiologists read images, but in tonight's case, we're going to talk about treating different abnormalities that we do the treatment with imaging guidance. So my job is to talk about killing tumors with scans, not scalpels. And we don't really kill them with the scans, but we find them to be killed with the scans. And the Star Wars theme, I tried to include that. And I think this is me because I went to medical school a long time ago. And I have a great young team of other people who do ablations besides me, including Maureen. And we have a good group, but I'm the Yoda in the group because I've done a lot of these tumor ablations. And I apologize if some of this may be too basic, but I wanted to touch on all aspects and a spectrum of information for people. So first of all, where are your kidneys, since I'm going to talk about kidney tumors? Well, they're really close to your spine. They're right below the back muscles, and they're right under your lungs. There's the lungs, the diaphragm, and then you're really right into the kidneys, but they're way in the back of you, so that's important to know. And they're critical. They're essential for fluid and metabolic balance, so things like potassium and sodium all depend on the function of your kidneys. What about kidney cancer? Is this an important thing? Well, actually, it's really quite common, not as common as prostate or lung or breast cancer, but it's quite common. And in the United States in 2015, it's estimated that there'll be 61,560 new cases of kidney cancer. That's quite a few. And of those patients and the ones who had it before, there'll be almost 15,000 deaths in 2015. Your lifetime risk is 1 out of 63 people will get kidney cancer. There are some risk factors, although most of this is really just luck. Men, smokers, obesity, some unusual chemical exposures like cadmium risk increase the risk. People who are on dialysis have an increased risk of kidney cancer, and then some rare hereditary conditions. Very interesting thing about this, treating these, is almost the story is almost always the same, that these are found incidentally. This is very different from when I went to medical school, where people presented with blood in their urine or they presented with metastatic disease. Nowadays, almost everybody is scanned for some reason other than their kidneys. They've got abdominal pain, appendicitis, some abnormality that they're scanning them, and we happen upon a kidney tumor. That's good, because those kidney tumors are usually small, and they're usually not symptomatic, and they're usually curable. About kidney cancer, there are some good news and bad news aspects of it. It's a kind of an unusual tumor, and I brought up this Jekyll and Hyde profile for it. The good news is, when we find these, they tend to grow very slowly, in the range of about 3 or 4 millimeters a year. So that's like a 16th of an inch in diameter they grow a year, on average. They don't spread when they're small. It's very, very rare if they're less than 3 centimeters, which is a little over an inch, that they would ever spread anywhere beyond that tumor. And if they haven't spread, the cure rate is very, very high. Again, greater than 90%. The bad news is, if it has spread, it's really not likely to be curable. So the cure rate is less than 10% if it's too late. And the treatments, really, there's not great treatment for it. Chemotherapy, radiation may slow it down a little bit. There's a rare case where somebody is cured, but again, the cure rate is very, very low. So good news, if we catch it early, easy to cure. Catch it late, not very good. What does it look like? Well, here's a kidney that's been bivalved like an oyster, and what I'm pointing to here, this little ball-shaped mass, it's about the size of a ping pong ball, is a kidney cancer, and that's what it looks like if the kidney were taken out. What does it look like on a scan? By now in your careers in medical school, you've probably seen lots of CT scans. This is, again, like slicing a loaf of bread. Patient is laying on the table with their feet towards us, so we're looking up at their liver and their spleen, and these are the kidneys. And the diagnosis of kidney cancer is all imaging these days. So you don't operate to find these. These are all found and with almost 100% accuracy diagnosed with imaging. And it's pretty simple. We see a ball-shaped mass on the kidney, and it lights up when we give that X-ray dye that they inject in the veins. That goes everywhere where there's blood flow. So there's blood flow to this tumor. It lights up. And that is those particular findings almost clinch the diagnosis that this is cancer. We might biopsy it before treating it. Before I talk about different treatment options, I wanted to make sure that you knew what I was going to talk about, percutaneous ablation. So percutaneous means we work through the skin. That's good and bad. The good news is no cutting. There's no incisions, just a needle puncture. The bad news is we don't have as much control as a surgeon. We can't touch what we're working on. If there's bleeding, it's hard for us to stop that with our tools because we're, again, working outside the body. But percutaneous means through the skin. Ablation means destruction. And people often ask, what happens to the tumor? Well, it's killed, but we don't remove it. It just turns into scar tissue, like petrified tissue. It's completely dead. There may be still a lump there, but it can't grow and cannot spread. It is cured if all goes well. So for all kinds of kidney treatment, kidney cancer treatment, we have really three goals. The single most important one, if we're going to do treatment, is to cure the cancer. If we fail at that, it doesn't matter how well we do at these other things. So that's our primary goal. But secondly, it's very important to preserve kidney function. Again, we don't want to disable people or even years down the road have them develop problems where they might need to undergo dialysis or perhaps die from lack of kidney function. And finally, if all those work out, we'd like the treatment to have little morbidity, morbidity meaning illness or disability, and we certainly don't want any mortality or very, very rare mortality. So those are our goals. What are the options? Well, these for kidney cancer, there are several options, and I'll explain each of those. Nephrectomy. So this is when I went to medical school. This was the standard treatment for 75 years. If you had a kidney cancer, they took your kidney out. It was easy. And the dogma I learned in medical school was if you have two normal kidneys, you can take one out and you'll be just fine. And that pretty much holds true, but they're a little bit more careful nowadays. So what's evolved is a partial nephrectomy. That's also surgery. They take the kidney tumor out and a little bit of kidney around it, but they preserve most of the kidney whenever they can. The benefit of that is they don't decrease the kidney function nearly as much, but it's much more complicated surgery. We can do percutaneous ablation, which I'm going to talk about. And finally, there's surveillance imaging. This isn't really treatment, but we know that these tumors grow very slowly. They don't spread till they reach a certain threshold, so it's quite safe to watch these for a while. So if we have someone who's not very healthy, they may well die with this tumor rather than of the tumor. And again, we have to make those decisions with the patient, of course, makes the final decision. How well do these work? Well, it turns out that this partial nephrectomy and the complete nephrectomy basically work the same. The partial's technically more difficult. The surgeons can't do it in every single case, depending where the tumor is located. They can't always cut it out, but most of them, they can. And the surgeons here are very, very talented. I've been amazed at how well they do the surgery here with very few complications. Has a great cure rate, greater than 90%. It's not perfect. So sometimes local recurrence, that means they've taken the tumor out, but perhaps a tiny bit of it was left in place, and it grows back. About 3% of the time, and about 6% of the time, people develop metastatic disease. And what that means is it was already there at the time of surgery. We just couldn't see it. It was too small. But this is nearly perfect. Again, greater than 90%. That's quite good for a lethal cancer like this. There are some issues with this, though. Surgery is fantastic, but it's a big operation. How many people in this room have ever had surgery? I've never had surgery. I would imagine it's a pretty big thing to recover. Surgery to take the whole kidney out is a big incision, and even though you may get out of the hospital in a few days, it really takes weeks or months to recuperate from that. And if they have to take your whole kidney, it turns out that about 1 in 5 people will end up developing some deficiency of renal function later in their life, and that correlates with a shortened lifespan, not because of renal failure, but because of some unknown factors. People can develop heart disease, strokes, things that are not related directly to kidney function, but they do have a shorter lifespan. Not always, but it correlates with that. So comes along ablation in the late 1990s, and it turns out over years we've learned that for smaller tumors, so for this definition, that means 4 centimeters or less, that the cure rate is really equal to that of surgery. So this is a very good technique, and it's taken a long time to prove that. So the treatment of this surgery versus percutaneous for small kidney tumors, the first goal, curing cancer, is equal. Again, 4 centimeters or smaller. Surgery definitely has substantially higher morbidity. Again, not mortality, but the recuperation period is much more extensive. When we do an ablation, people go back to their normal activities the next day. Even that night, they may feel almost completely normal. And it's quite a bit more costly to do surgery. They're in the hospital longer, more complications, more equipment. So why not do this on everybody? Well, surgery's been around for 75 years, and we know a long track record for that. And we can't do better than that. So there's still a little bit of doubt about what happens with this 20 years down the road. If we treat a 40-year-old, what will it be like when he's 80? Is he really cured, or does it just look like he's cured based on our CT scan when he was 45? We don't really know, so we're a little cautious about using this in very young, healthy patients, whereas most patients now, this is a very good option. So when you rank these options, and I think the urologists here believe this as well, I meet with them all the time, is that if someone has an early-stage kidney cancer, meaning it's smaller, 4 centimeters or less, and it hasn't spread anywhere, partial nephrectomy is a great treatment. Percutaneous ablation is a great treatment. If they're older or very elderly or infirmed, they may not need any treatment, but we will watch them very carefully. If the tumor reaches that threshold size or approaches it where we worry about spread, then we would recommend doing one of these treatments. And nephrectomy, where you take the whole kidney out, really reserve that for larger tumors like this one that's about 10 centimeters and taking over the entire upper half of the left kidney. This is a scan like the patient is standing there looking at us. It's called a coronal view. So that's reserved now for larger tumors. So let's talk about ablation. What is this all about? Well, there are different techniques. If those of you who have done your homework and researched this, you probably know there's heating and freezing. Heating is done with two different main techniques, radio frequency, which sounds like radio waves, and it is radio waves, but it generates a lot of heat. It's very much like microwave energy. Microwave actually is newer to this forum, and it's probably equivalent, but there's not nearly as much data for that, whereas radio frequency, we have a lot of data. And freezing is called cryoablation, so that's where we put in a probe, and we freeze the tumor to death. I'll show you some pictures. This is what it looks like. It sounds like it's a very powerful tool, and it is, but it's a very small tool, so that's my hand. This is a probe, and it's really no bigger than the needles that are used to draw blood out of your vein. And these are placed under CT guidance. This is an animal liver that I did an ablation on just to show what this looks like. This would be the living liver, and it's very sharply demarcated, this cooked area. All of that would be dead if it were a tumor or liver. Here's what this looks like when we're doing it. That's me. I'm a little while ago. This is when I first started, and my hair was a little bit browner there. Now it's kind of gray of what I have left. But this was the first day I did an ablation in 1999, and you see we do this in the CT scanner. This was one of my coworkers back then. This is what the ablation probe looks like. We put it in through the skin. There's no incision. There's no stitches. This is Band-Aid treatment. You end up with a Band-Aid at the end of this. Cryoablation, the probes look basically the same, but we pump a freezing liquid through them that expands into a gas. It's argon or liquid nitrogen, and it gets unbelievably cold, minus 200 degrees Celsius kind of temperatures, and it creates an ice ball around it that freezes the tissue to death. This all happens in a matter of minutes. Here's what that looks like. Here's a CT scan with a patient with a tumor in their kidney. That's the tumor. That's the kidney. Here's the cryo probe. I actually have a couple of probes. You can barely see the other one. And this tumor is being frozen. I know it's being frozen because it gets a little bit darker. The ice actually shows up very black on the CT scan. It's darker than the normal kidney. And you can see very sharply demarcated where the end of the ice ball is. And all of that tissue would be killed instantly by this freezing. Does this work? Well, here's some data. I'm on this. I published the first large series of proven kidney cancers that were ablated. And overall, of all these this data and much more since then, it's basically identical to surgery for these small tumors, 94% cure rate. Turns out we were worried originally about where the tumors were, like perhaps tumors that were in the middle of the kidney because there's a lot of blood flow there, might be harder to kill. But it turns out we did a study, didn't matter where they were. The only thing that mattered was the kidney size was the determining factor of whether this was successful. What about freezing versus heating? Well, they're basically work similarly, the technique's slightly different, but the data now shows these are basically identical, both in success rate and in complication rate. It's purely personal preference. I personally had a lot of experience with heating. My colleagues like to do freezing, but the results over a long period of time are identical. The risk of complications, less than 5%. That's still substantial. The complications, though, are very they're not minor, but you rarely, I haven't done thousands of these. I can remember one patient where we actually had to intervene more than doing something like a blood transfusion. People don't need surgery for these kind of complications. There are infections, there are bleeding that might require a transfusion. And so the technique is just a matter of personal preference. What about goal number two, preserving kidney function? Well, part of this is the excitement of a new technique. As I got to see this, I was an early adopter of this and did many thousands of cases. And back then, partial nephrectomies were really not nearly as popular as they are now. So we were kind of competing with radical nephrectomies. And we saw good results. Here's a tumor. That's the normal kidney. Here's the other kidney. That's a little cyst in that. But that's the kidney cancer. Here's the patient laying on their stomach. I've got the ablation probe in it, and I'm actually in the act of ablating this. And then this is a year later. And remember, we inject the X-ray dye to see if things are alive. Here, this is the tumor. It shrunk a little bit after the heating, a year later. And now we give the X-ray dye, and there is absolutely no blood flow to this tumor. But the thing that we noticed right away was very little normal kidney didn't get blood flow. So we were damaging only a tiny, basically a sliver of kidney, and we expected probably we're not causing much kidney damage. We did several studies. Here's one that the urologist where I worked with studied a group of patients I had treated, 77, and the standard now for measuring your kidney function is called the estimated glomerular filtration rate, how well your kidneys filter your blood. And before ablation, in this series of patients, it was 52. 12 months after ablation, 52. It was basically zero change. And that is better than the published results for surgery. We weren't really comparing to surgery, but compared to published results, it was better. So quickly, how do you do this? It's pretty simple. We biopsy the tumor to get a sample to prove that it's cancer. And then we do multiple short ablations, and I mean like 4-minute long ablations. The whole procedure takes between 1 and 2 hours. For a few hours afterwards, people are drowsy, have a little bit of back pain, but after a few hours, they're nearly normal, if not normal. We do keep them overnight just to observe them, give them pain medicine, make sure that the anesthesia has worn off. They go home the next morning, resume normal activities, no restrictions at all. Usually no further treatment is required. About 1 out of 10 times, we may have to do a second ablation. Here's a case I did recently, person laying on their back. Here are the kidneys. That's the left kidney. Here's this tumor that measures 3 centimeters. That's a biopsy-proven kidney cancer. Now I've turned the patient over. There's the kidney. There's that lump that is the kidney tumor on there sticking off out of the back of the kidney. And I've turned them over because it's close. The skin is close to the tumor. Here are these low-dose CT scans because we have to do quite a few CT scans during the procedure, so we use exceptionally low dose. The good news is it's good for the patient. The bad news is they're a little bit noisy to look at, grainy, but good enough to see. So here's my probe. I do one edge, then I go through the middle of it, then I get the other edge, and then at the end I give X-ray dye to see did it work. Here's the normal kidney. Here's the ablation margin, very sharply demarcated. There's the dead tumor. Tumor ablated, small margin of normal kidney, because there might be a tiny bit of tumor I can't see. And the whole thing took 45 minutes. There are, you know, not everybody is a perfect setup for this. Here's a patient with a tumor, but the colon's so close. This heat or freezing will damage anything that it touches. So we have to be careful. So what we do is we inject fluid. I've injected this fluid. I put a little contrast in it so I can see what I'm injecting. And now here's the tumor, and the bowel's been moved plenty far away that I can put the probes in and destroy this tumor without injuring anything near there. And it's rare to have any kind of serious complications. Remember I said we turned this into scar tissue? Well, this is what it looks like over years. Here's one a few years out. Here's the treated tumor. Here's the untreated tumor. This is while I'm treating the tumor. So right at the end, I gave X-ray dye. No enhancement of the tumor. Killed a little bit of normal kidney, but not enough to damage the renal function. And then it gets a little more organized and shrunken over the years. But basically, it just turns into this hard, petrified tissue. This is the kind of thing that we should absolutely avoid. And this is a real case. I moved here from North Carolina a few years ago. And this came from a rural hospital. I saw this scan not for an ablation, but because they were being treated for some other reason. And they came from a hospital where they didn't do ablations. And this patient had bad heart failure. They did not feel they were a good candidate for surgery because of their heart disease. And they got a scan, I don't know why really, and they found this tumor in the upper part of the right kidney. And the radiologist read this and said, this looks like a kidney cancer. But the patient was not a surgical candidate. This would have been a simple ablation, 45 minutes. So they watched it. A year later, it's bigger, getting to be the point where it's a little bit harder to treat with ablation, but could be done. But the patient didn't have that option where they were. And then the next year, it was really quite large, still maybe ablatable. But unfortunately, on that same scan, we saw that the tumor had now spread into the vein, and this was incurable. So unfortunately, we could have easily ablated this. And of course, if you come to UCSF, you would never be put in this situation because you would get referred for this minimally invasive procedure. But this could absolutely be avoided in their current situation. So remember the treatment options. Partial nephrectomy, percutaneous, surveillance imaging are all very reasonable option. We do have to make some decisions with the patient, and nephrectomy is reserved. How do we decide? Well, ablation is a great treatment option for small kidney tumors that haven't spread. We decide by committee. Of course, the patient is advised, but we present these cases in a multidisciplinary group with urologists, oncologists, radiation therapists, and radiologists, interventional radiologists like me, and we say, what would be best for the patient? What options should we offer them? Is this a tumor that could be easily resected in a young, healthy patient, or does this patient have some comorbidities where perhaps ablation would be better? So that's how we come to our recommendations. The cure rate for ablation is basically equal to resection. The risk of serious complications is not zero, but it's quite low, and the complications are really, although serious, they're not that serious. In anticipation of some things you might ask me, I wanted to touch on a couple of other points. Kidney cancer is really an ideal tumor for this. I've done liver tumors and lung tumors and lots of other tumors. When this first came out, we didn't know exactly what the best situation was, and we tried it for a lot of other tumors. But this is perfect because we can, with imaging, we see everything in the kidney. If there's a tumor there, we'll see it. If we've cured it, we'll know. Unlike other areas, like liver, we may see some tumors, but when they go to surgery, they may find spread in areas that we couldn't see well, or even tiny tumors in the liver which were not shown on scans. That happens. In the kidney, these are primary tumors, meaning that they started there. They're usually single tumors, and they usually have not spread because we find them at an early stage. And they don't metastasize earlier, like pancreas tumors might be small, but they spread very early on, and usually it's too late by the time we've made the diagnosis to even consider doing any kind of a treatment like this. The cure rate for kidney cancer is highly likely with ablation, again, comparable to surgery. And we follow this with imaging because we didn't cut the tumor out. We have to follow this with imaging, and the imaging is very, very accurate. What about percutaneous ablations in general? Well, these techniques are useful for some other tumors. Liver tumors like metastatic disease or cancers that start in the liver are sometimes treated with this. It's not as effective because there are other complicating features, bone tumors. Matt Buckner does this. He'll talk to you about ways to treat bone tumors, one particularly interesting way. Some lung tumors, some prostate tumors can be treated with ablation, but they're not as simple as kidney tumors. And this is not used for widespread disease. It's not used for the pancreas. It's a very delicate organ where you can't do this kind of technique. It's not used in hollow organs like intestines or bladder because you get holes in those organs from the heat or the freezing. And it's not used in the brain, although that might be a great application. It's hard to use this in that because of the risk of complications, although some animal studies are being done. So thanks for your attention. We're going to save the questions till the end. We've got three other speakers, and next is Matt Buckner, who's in our musculoskeletal section, and he's going to talk about treating bone lesions. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking tonight about high-intensity focused ultrasound, which is a really exciting new way we have of destroying tumors here at UCSF. Traditionally, for bone and soft tissue tumors, if we wanted to do a focal ablation, we would do something similar to what Dr. Zagoria just described, a percutaneous ablation with radiofrequency, for example. But HIFU represents a really exciting new way of attacking tumors, and we're attacking them with focused sound energy. It's a really great new technology that we have here. So over the course of the next 15 to 20 minutes, I'm going to talk about how does HIFU work, and then I'm going to dig into some novel treatments that we're doing here at UCSF. So first of all, how does it work? So HIFU works with focused sound waves, just like the name implies, high-intensity focused ultrasound. So we used focused sound waves to generate heat at a single point. When I'm trying to explain patients exactly how that works, the best analogy that I have is the magnifying glass. So the same idea as a magnifying glass, focusing the sun's light waves to focus and generate heat at a single point. We can do the same thing with sound waves and create heat at a single point with HIFU. So how hot does it get? It gets really hot, and it gets really hot really fast. It'll get up to 75 to 85 degrees Celsius or 170 to 185 degrees Fahrenheit in 20 seconds. And every time we fire that burst of sound energy, we refer to that as a sonication, just so we're on the same terminology. We guide our targeting and the delivery of the sound energy with MRI. That allows us to be really precise with exactly where we're delivering the energy, helps us avoid critical structures, and make sure we're able to completely destroy our tumor target. And then that guidance by MRI also facilitates something that we like to call closed-loop therapy, and I'm going to take a minute and just describe that. Part of the idea of HIFU is that when we bring a patient in for treatment, we can take some MRI images on the same day that we're planning to treat them. We'll just take 5 or 10 minutes and do a series of images to get a sense of exactly what the tumor looks like that exact day. Then we can plan some targeting based on those images. So we take those images, they go into a dedicated workstation. Our workstation generates a treatment plan, and then we edit the treatment plan, look for critical things that we want to avoid, look for areas where we want to deliver more energy, and create an optimized treatment plan for that specific tumor and that specific patient that day. Then we go ahead and do our sonication. So these are bursts of sound energy. We're firing them in 20-second intervals. We wait for some cooling in between each sound burst, make sure the machine doesn't overheat. And then at the end, when we feel like we've done everything we need to do, we can do some more MRI images, get a sense of what we've done, get a sense of if there's more areas that we need to go back and treat a little bit more. It allows us to be very safe and very complete and effective with our treatments. One of the really important parts of this technology is that we're able to monitor the sound energy while we're delivering it. I think that's a really exciting development that's happened over the last 15 to 20 years with regard to MRI that has allowed and made HIFU possible. So we use a special MRI sequence that measures the temperature of the tissue at the same time that we're delivering the sound energy. It's a really incredible technique. So over that 20 seconds that we're firing the sound energy out of this machine, we're acquiring images that are telling us exactly what's the difference in temperature between the baseline state of that tissue and at the end of our sonication. That way we can make sure that we're delivering enough sound energy, get things just hot enough, but not too hot as to damage other structures. Here's a screenshot of what that temperature, that thermometry sequence looks like. And at the top of this screenshot, you can see there's a series of images. I'm not going to get into the details of the tumor in this case, but those images are acquired every single second. So over the course of 5, 10, 15, 20 seconds, we can watch as this color overlay is generated and shows us where heat is being accumulated within the tumor target. At the end of the 20 seconds, we get a nice color map that shows us exactly where the heating is in terms of 3x3 pixels and the single hottest pixel. That's the green versus red differentiation there. We also get a little chart if we want to really drill down and see exactly how long did it get, how hot. So that allows us to be very, very thorough about our treatment and figuring out exactly how much energy we've delivered. This is the table, our high food table that we use down at UCSF. The company that makes it is Insightech, and it works with GE scanners. Okay, it looks just like a normal GE MRI table with a couple of interesting differences. The first, you might notice this very, very long, thick cord that's going towards the center of the table. Right in the center of the table is the transducer. So that cord is the energy source that's heading towards that transducer, which is the device that's generating the sound energy within the table. We'll then take that table and get it set up, plug it into the MRI machine, and then position the patient over top of that device that's in the center of the table, right? So that device, it can't really move. It can move a little bit within the table, maybe 5 to 10 centimeters, but we need to try to get the patient and the tumor within the patient that we're trying to treat directly over that device in the center of the table. So in this case, this is a woman receiving a treatment for a uterine fibroid. We need to have her laying on her stomach so that we can target that fibroid. This is just another schematic of that same concept. Again, you can see this positioning system. This is our transducer, the device that's generating sound energy. You can see this cone-shaped beam of sound energy that it's creating to target this tumor deep within the body. So the benefits of HIFU are really quite a few. It's completely non-invasive, which means there's no significant risk of bleeding or infection. There's no ionizing radiation. So some of the tumors that we target with HIFU, we used to treat with radiation. And that worked to some extent in different, you know, depending on the exact tumor. But of course, radiation has side effects, has immediate side effects, and sometimes there's a risk of malignancy down the road. So we like to avoid that whenever possible. We can also be very precise with our targeting with HIFU. We're creating these little areas of heat that are no bigger than a centimeter, you know, less than half of an inch. We're able to create and focal, very, very precise heating. Now, that allows us to sort of paint the tumor half an inch by half an inch, and it creates a very, very effective, very safe treatment. Because that side effect profile is so great with HIFU, we're also able to repeat it. So we can do treatments in intervals. We can stage treatments and do half of a tumor one day, half of a tumor the next day. It really allows us a lot of flexibility with regard to creating a comprehensive treatment plan for a patient. So what do we use HIFU for? What do we use this great technology for? Well, the leading indication is by far and away uterine fibroids. That's sort of the first main application that was developed for HIFU. And of course, Dr. Kohi and Dr. Lager are going to talk a little bit about that later. My main interest, being a musculoskeletal radiologist, are bone and soft tissue tumors, and I'll tell you about some of the new treatments that we're doing here in just a little bit. Essential tremor, a real landmark study came out a couple of years that demonstrated that HIFU could be used to actually generate focal areas of sound heating within the brain and target the source of essential tremor in certain patients. Prostate cancer, there are research trials that showing it to be promising for prostate cancer. And then low back pain as well. There are targets within the spine that we know to be pain generators that we can target and treat and improve people's back pain. So let's dig into the bone and soft tissue tumors. So there are three main ones that we're treating here at UCSF. The first is desmoid tumors. The second are osteoid osteomas. And the third are bone metastases, and that's cancer that's spread to the bone in patients with malignancies that came from a different organ. So we'll take those each in turn. So desmoid tumors. Desmoid tumors are benign soft tissue tumors that arise from connective tissue. They're very slow growing, okay, but they're very locally aggressive. So these tumors will develop oftentimes in a limb, in the thigh. I see a number of patients that develop them in the lower extremities. And they'll just notice a lump, and then we'll do an imaging sequence, and we'll be able to recognize the characteristic features of a desmoid tumor. Oftentimes, the patient will go on and have a biopsy, and that will be clear what the diagnosis is. The tricky thing with desmoid tumors is that You know, this is a list of some of the conventional treatments that I'm sure you've heard of: surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. These are all standard treatments for desmoid tumors, but they all present certain problems in terms of really creating an optimal therapy. So the problem with surgery with desmoid tumors is the rate of recurrence for this particular tumor. So even though it's benign, it's very locally aggressive. So even if there's just a little bit of microscopic disease that's still there after the surgery, the tumor will come back, it'll infiltrate the scar planes and kind of create a bigger mess than you had to begin with. So sometimes you'll hear stories of surgeons who keep trying to resect a tumor. They'll keep bringing a patient back over and over. And because that tumor is able to be infiltrative and grow along scar planes, ultimately sometimes those patients end up with amputations. So that's not an ideal solution by any means. Radiation, the trouble with radiation is that these patients are often young, and again, we want to avoid radiation in young patients often. And then chemotherapy, there's no chemotherapy that seems to clearly work all the time, and many of the ones that people have proposed have significant toxicities. So I just want to talk through two cases that we've done here. The first case is a 7-year-old boy with a recurrent desmoid tumor that was referred to me. He had previously, 3 years before he was referred to me, he had had surgery, he'd had radiation, he had chemotherapy. So I had a lot of very good standard treatments for treating this desmoid tumor. Despite all those different treatments, this was his tumor. So this is a coronal MRI image, so we're slicing through the body like so. And you can see that this large sort of white oval lesion within his thigh, that's his recurrent desmoid tumor. So after he initially had surgery, you couldn't see any evidence of the tumor on his scans. And just 3 years later, the tumor had come back and grown to this size. So really, really discouraging turn of events. Because he had had all these other treatments and none of them seemed to really be working, he was referred to me for evaluation for high-intensity focused ultrasound. And he seemed like a really good candidate, so we moved forward and we did a treatment. I just want to show you some of the images that we acquired immediately following the treatment. So this is in a different position. Instead of slicing through the body coronal, this is an axial image, so we're transversely cutting through the body. And this is his thigh, you know, so this is just one slice through that tumor that I'm showing you. We're slicing through everything here, obviously, right? So this is the treatment table. This is actually that transducer, that device within the table that's generating the sound energy. We use a gel pad with almost all of these treatments. That allows us to have good coupling of sound between the device and the patient. And then here's his tumor within his thigh. Okay, but you'll notice something very different already immediately following the treatment. So this is just in the 5 to 10 minutes after we did the HIFU treatment. You can see that instead of that that bright signal that we saw before the treatment, again, we had given dye on that pre-treatment image to show us where tumor was alive and where it was dead, and that tumor was completely bright, so suggesting that it was completely alive. Now in the series of images that we acquired after the treatment, we see that it's completely dark centrally. So a really incredible treatment result that we had for this tumor that had recurred after many of our standardized treatments. So let's move forward and talk about osteoid osteomas. Osteoid osteomas are benign bone tumors. The thing, you know, most benign tumors don't end up being a significant problem, but the challenge with osteoid osteomas are that they are incredibly painful. Patients often will describe having to or waking up in the middle of the night in excruciating pain from these tumors. And they'll end up being on these complicated regimens of pain medication to try to keep their pain under control. And the reason these tumors are so painful is that in the center of the tumor is this little engine that produces hormones which generate pain. That's its explicit job. And that makes it a really incredibly painful tumor compared to other small benign bone lesions. So our conventional treatment is radiofrequency ablation. So similar to what we do to treat certain renal tumors, we would take a needle, we would drill into the bone, place the needle within the bone, and then heat up the tip of that needle to try to ablate or destroy that tumor with an electrical current. But because we have HIFU here at UCSF, and we know that there's some great data that was coming from some other countries describing HIFU as being very effective for osteoid osteomas, we wanted to try it here. So we were actually the first, I think, in California, the second in the country to try HIFU for ablation of an osteoid osteoma. This is the patient that was referred to me, a 23-year-old man who had had osteoid osteoma. Again, he was on one of those very complicated pain regimens. He was telling me that he had to set his alarm to wake up exactly every night at 3 a.m., or he was going to wake up in excruciating pain if he hadn't had the dose of medicine right then. So this is his tumor. This is an axial CT image. Again, we're slicing this way through the body. And you can see that the normal cortex, or outer shell of the bone, looks just sort of white. And the central marrow space, that's a little bit darker. But you can see if we're following along the cortex here that we encounter this little dark spot. That's his tumor. And that's the area, we call it the nidus of the tumor, that's producing the hormones that are creating the pain. So I can show it to you on a couple of other imaging planes. This is that coronal imaging plane again. Again, you see this just little dark spot where the tumor is. Same thing again with the sagittal. So now we're slicing through the body like so. Again, a small little dark spot. That's the nidus of the tumor. And then you see that how kind of inflammatory this tumor is, because you can see that the cortex along this side of the bone, it's much thicker than this side of the bone, okay? And that cortex, that's not actually part of the tumor. It's bone reacting to this very inflammatory, very painful lesion. So this is him on our treatment table. Again, this is an axial image. Again, we have the transducer within the table. We have the gel pad. And then it's a little bit hard to see, but that kind of faint lightness in the center of the cortex there, that's his tumor again, which we targeted. This is that same screenshot that I showed you earlier, and this was this particular specific patient. And you can see that we were able to get great heating within that tumor, within that nidus. You can see right here, I don't want to cover it up here, but you can see in this area where we have our color overlay, we get great heating at the edge of the bone. That's exactly where we want our heating to be. And it really just took, I think this was the seventh sonication when we felt like we were done. So 20-second sonication, seven of them, and the patient's tumor was treated. He actually, his pain, you know, that he had for a year resolved within 3 to 5 days, and he has not had pain since. I still keep in close contact with him, and he's doing really, really well. So a lot of what I've told you might make it sound like HIFU is too good to be true. And so it's important just to understand, you know, any medical intervention has risks. I'm going to talk a little bit about the risks and limitations of HIFU. So for one, there's a risk of injury to skin or structures adjacent to the target. And that's because we're delivering such a tremendous amount of energy through the skin and into the patient near this tumor, right? So every time it goes through, the sound energy goes through an interface, there's a risk for some of that energy to be absorbed at that interface. So in order to protect the skin, we have patients lying in a little shallow bath of water. That really has dramatically decreased the risk of a skin burn to the point where we don't really hear of it happening very often. Structures adjacent to the target, that kind of depends on the tumor, right? So some tumors are near things that we really don't want to affect. You know, Dr. Zagori gave a great example of a renal tumor next to bowel. Bowel is something we want to protect. Nerves are things that we want to protect. And we just have to take it tumor by tumor and decide how to optimize the treatment plan for the patient. Another point is that sound energy does not travel all the way through bone. So while osteoid osteomas are great because they always develop on the surface of the bone, it might be hard if you needed to try to target a soft tissue tumor that was on the opposite side of a bone. You wouldn't be able to get much of your sound energy through. And so HIFU would be limited use in that situation. And then similarly, HIFU doesn't really do well with motion. So you can imagine if you're there with your magnifying glass trying to concentrate the sun's light waves, if you're moving that glass from side to side, it's going to take a long time to create any heat. The same kind of issue arises for HIFU. And then finally, not all tumors heat well. So some tumors respond much better to the heat and the sound energy than other tumors. And that's the case certainly for different fibroids, and I think Dr. Coey might get into that. So in summary, HIFU, it's an exciting new way of attacking tumors with sound energy. It's FDA approved for treatment of uterine fibroids and bone metastases. We're doing those treatments here at UCSF, and then we're also pioneering some novel treatments of bone and soft tissue tumors, such as desmoid tumors and osteoid osteomas. So thank you very much for your attention. So let me introduce Dr. Maureen Coey in our interventional radiology department, and then Dr. Lager.
Okay, thank you. So it's a pleasure to be with you guys tonight to talk about uterine fibroids. You know, I think that when you're talking about symptomatic uterine fibroids, it's much better to hear the story from a gynecologist and also one as talented as my dear friend Jeanette Lager, who sees these patients initially. And at UCSF, we have a very lovely collaboration between radiology and interventional radiology and gynecology. So this is one of the beauties of working here, because you just pick up the phone, and just today I saw a patient referred her right back to Jeanette for surgery. So that's one of the perks of the job. So I'd like to start off by just letting Dr. Lager tell you a little bit about fibroids, and then I'll pick up and start talking about some of the procedures we do, and she'll talk about some of the exciting things that they do in gynecology.
So we're going to, as she said, we're going to talk about three things today. We're going to talk about fibroids and just basic overview of fibroids. She's going to talk about some of the radiological interventions, and then we'll talk about one other novel therapy. So why talk about fibroids? It's the most common benign tumor in women of reproductive age. About one in five women have fibroids, and over 35, about 50% have fibroids. There are many contributing factors, and some of them include age. As age increases, fibroids, the rate of fibroids increase, although they do tend to get smaller in menopause. African-American women tend to have a higher rate of fibroids. Early menarche or early periods are associated with fibroids. And then actually, parity decreases the rate of fibroids. And after pregnancy, sometimes fibroids will shrink down approximately 80%. There is a familial association, so some people have families that many women have fibroids in the family, and there are a few genetic predispositions to fibroids as well. Most women are asymptomatic, but about one in four are symptomatic, and they can suffer from significant symptoms, which include menorrhagia, which is heavy menstrual bleeding that can be so bad that they can be anemic and sometimes need blood transfusions, dyspareunia, which is pain with sex, pelvic pain or pressure from the mass effect of the fibroids, frequent urination, which is associated with the fibroids being so large that they push against the bladder and patients feel almost like being pregnant, that they have to get up constantly to go to the bathroom, and constipation due to the pressure against the bowels. In 2011, FIGO, which is one of the OBGYN organizations, created a classification system for fibroids, and they classified 0 through 3 as submucosal fibroids, and I'll go into more detail about that. 4 is intramural fibroids, which is based on the location, so the ones that are in the middle of the muscle. And then 5 through 8, which are subserosal or pedunculated. The subserosal fibroids are the ones that are located on the outer wall of the uterus or are pedunculated. They tend to cause symptoms that are not as much related to bleeding, but more related to the bulk symptoms, so pelvic pressure, bladder pressure, bowel pressure. The intramural fibroids develop in the middle of the uterine wall, and they are the most common fibroids. It, depending on the size of the fibroids or what types of symptoms they cause. If they're more towards the middle of the uterus, sometimes they can cause heavy bleeding and cramping. When they're larger, they can cause similar symptoms to the subserosal ones, so pressure symptoms. The submucosal fibroids develop just under the uterine lining. They are the least common fibroids, but they tend to cause the worst symptoms. So the ones that are in the middle part of the uterus tend to cause the middle part to distend a little bit more during periods. It causes heavier periods and heavier cramping with their periods. It's also associated with decreased pregnancy rates, decreased live birth rates, and increased miscarriage, and removal of submucosal fibroids have been shown to improve that. So this is just a list of the treatment options, which include expectant management, medical management, minimally invasive surgery, and open surgeries, and the radiological procedures. And Dr. Kohi is going to be our expert about those radiological procedures.
Thank you. So I'm an interventional radiologist, so that means that the majority of my time is actually dedicated to doing procedures as well as looking at images. And there are two procedures that I like to do for women with symptomatic uterine fibroids, and one is called MR-guided focus ultrasound, which is exactly the same as HIFU. So we just wanted to confuse you guys. So HIFU is high-intensity focus ultrasound, and MR-guided focus ultrasound, or FUS sometimes, or FUS, is exactly the same thing. It's just potato, potato. And then there is an endovascular option, which is uterine artery embolization, and I'll just briefly touch on that. Now, MR-guided focus ultrasound, Dr. Buchner talked a lot about this, so I'll just quickly go through it again. Basically, what you're dealing with is an ultrasound. How many of you have had ultrasounds in your life? Right. More women, clearly. So, but the ultrasound sound waves that were emitted into your skin were very low in energy. So they went in, they saw the tissue, and came back and gave us information on the images. For high-intensity focus ultrasound, those sound waves are really powerful, and they're meant to kill. And so that's why they're used under very specific conditions. As we talked about, there is ability to raise the temperature quite a bit into the tissue and cause cell death. The beauty of having MRI is not only can you see what you're doing, but you can also get information from the tissue of how hot you got in there. So in case you miss the point that you really want it to heat up, you can go back and reburn it so you can get really effective therapy. Dr. Buchner showed these images. Again, this is the table. This is the ultrasound. There's a sort of cool water that the female lies in, and that allows for protection of the skin. And this is another sort of very similar to what we saw in the earlier talk. Again, this is the transducer, which is the ultrasound. And you can see these sound waves that focus onto one spot, which is her fibroid. And here's the degassed water and the gel pad that we discussed that she is lying. Now, during this procedure, this is a little bit different. Our procedure is a little bit longer. It takes about 3 hours. And for those 3 hours, women are under moderate sedation, so they're in twilight. It's very similar to colonoscopy or endoscopy. So most patients will have absolutely no recollection of what they went through. And it helps for pain management. But we can't put them to sleep, and I'll tell you why. I do require the patients to be awake to react to what I'm doing because I really rely on their ability to communicate with me in order to prevent some of the complications. And I'll go through that in a little bit. So as I said, patients under have moderate sedation. You really want to make sure that that there is nothing else on the skin that could potentially be trapping the sound that would cause the reason for that is that it could cause skin burn. So we make sure that patients shave their abdomen or there isn't much hair. There can't be a scar in the way because then what can happen is you could burn the tissue of the scar and that could lead to bad complications. And additionally, what we like is because it takes 3 hours, we can't stop in the middle and have the female patient go to the bathroom. So we put in a Foley catheter into the bladder so you don't have to worry about holding your urine or having to use the restroom in the middle. Sometimes we actually have to put in a rectal tube, and I'll go into detail as to why that is. And a lot of reasons, a lot of the times, the reason is because the rectum sits right behind the uterus, and we need the uterus to be as pushed in front as possible to the transducer so it can get maximum burning. And sometimes in some patients, the uterus kind of flops backwards, and depending on where the fibroid is, there's too much distance for the heat to get to it, and in that case, you'd get ineffective therapy. So again, we want to maximize therapy. We want to maximize the kill rate. We do have, because it's, again, 3 hours of immobility, so we have our patients have compression stockings, and the thought behind that is that it allows the veins and the legs to kind of tighten up so more blood goes back to the heart, less blood kind of pools in the legs, and there's a fewer chance of developing a blood clot in the legs. So here's an example. This is the kind of cutting the patient in profile, sort of looking them from the side. This is the anterior abdomen. This is the spine. Here's the uterus. This dark solid round mass is the fibroid. And here is, again, the transducer. Here's the gel pad. And the aim is to send these sonications so that it can burn the fibroid. Here is when Dr. Buchner was saying that we want to make sure you don't burn something extra, you know. He in this patient, for example, you have the fibroid. It's quite a ways away from the anterior abdomen. And these little things in front, that's your intestine. So, you know, can you imagine? I'd burn your fibroid, but then I'd also give you a big problem with your intestine, and you'd be very upset at me. So we like to avoid situations like that. And as a result, we have a catheter in the bladder. So why not and infuse some saline and raise the bowel out of the way, in which case I can just burn through the bladder, which is totally fine because of all the liquid in it, and prevent any injury to the intestine. And this explains why the procedure can take several hours, because a lot of it is patient preparation. In another way, you have, again, the fibroid. You have intestine in front, and you have the rectum here in the back. And what we've done here is we've actually inflated the bladder a little bit, and we've put some gel in the rectum, and you can see that the uterus and the fibroid has moved forward so that the distance to kill it has decreased, which means that there is more high-intensity energy that can get into the fibroid and result in cell death. So there's a lot of internal movement that we have to do. And the good thing is the patient's sedated and she doesn't remember, she doesn't feel much of what's going on. So as we discussed, we do some MR imaging. We send it to our workstation. And during the time that we look at the images, and we'll try to come up with the best treatment plan and try to avoid things like the bowel or some neuroforamina where the nerves exit. So you don't want to be burning nerves, just like you don't want to be burning bowel. You just want to be burning just the fibroid. Here's an example similar to what Dr. Bruckner was showing you. Here we have the red dot over the part of the fibroid that we are sonicating, that we're burning. And because of the technology of the MRI, we are able to understand what the temperature what the temperature of the tissue that we burned got to be. Usually, as we discussed, the sonication lasts about 20 seconds. We do wait about 40 seconds for the cooling. And for us, for fibroids, it can take up to 100 sonications. So that's why it can take up to 3 or so hours, very different than bone tumors or smaller tumors where it could be a shorter time of treatment. And this is what it looks like. So these blue dot overlays are areas that we have sonicated. And this is a contrast-enhanced MRI. So we are done with the therapy, and we give the dye. And the uterus is this bright, healthy, white organ. And in the center is this dark area that is not being enhanced. And that is very much matches the blue overlay. How do we do? Well, this is actually based on slightly older data, and you can see that the chance of success or chance of improving your symptoms is really dependent on how much of the fibroid you burned, which makes sense. And the name of how much of the fibroid you burned is non-perfused volume, and that refers to the amount of the fibroid tissue that does not get perfusion, that does not get blood flow. So as you can see, if the degree of the killed area or the non-perfused volume of the fibroid is higher, the alternative therapies that patients undergo are lower. And that's why we spend so long trying to maximize the killing of the cells of the fibroid so that the patient don't need to have additional therapy. So who are the ideal patients? Usually patients who don't desire fertility. We don't know what this technology does to the uterus after we are done with it. So it's really not the best therapy for a young female who happens to have symptomatic fibroids and also wants to get pregnant. In those cases, I refer them back to Jeanette, just like I did today. Usually want them to have just a few fibroids because it takes a long time, and I don't want to be keeping the patients in the scanner for 8 hours immobile. Generally, what we'd like for them to have fibroids that are in the center or close to get to in the uterus, and not fibroids that are dangling off to the side, because usually those fibroids are in close proximity with other organs such as the ovaries or other intestines. As I said, you don't want any scars in the way because the patient can't feel the heat that's going through the scars and won't be able to communicate that you're burning the skin, and then you end up having a skin burn, which is a bad complication. And we don't want patients to have had other interventions such as uterine artery embolization, which I'll talk about, or an IUD in them. And the reason for that is for the uterine artery embolization, there are these little beads that are inside the fibroid. We don't know what happens to them when they're, you know, the temperature is raised to up to 80 degrees Celsius. And additionally, an IUD is usually of metal fragments, which can really get hot and can potentially injure the endometrium. And in terms of the characteristics of the fibroids, we want them to be darker and we want them to take up the contrast and be really bright, because we've learned that those fibroids do really well with this therapy. And we want them to be not very big, but generally my cutoff is it needs to be less than 10 centimeters, which, believe me, it's still very big. But if it's any bigger, we'd be there for hours and it would be very uncomfortable for the patient. So here's some examples. Here's a patient who had three fibroids. You could see 1, 2, 3. This pressing on the bladder. She felt a lot of pelvic pain and bulk symptoms, and they were avidly enhancing with gadolinium. They were really bright. And after we were done with the therapy, they're not enhancing anymore. They're all dead. She did great. Here's a patient who has a very large fibroid. Her fibroid's very heterogeneous. It's not dark. It's more what we call heterogeneous, because it has areas of darkness and it has areas of bright. And in this patient, when I was done with the therapy, she didn't do that well. So I was only able to burn a little bit of the fibroid. And as Dr. Buchner said, some tissues respond really well. And it's really hard to anticipate that sometimes. But usually if you identify the best patients according to the characteristics that I showed you, you end up with a higher chance of successful therapy. How effective is it? These are some studies that have demonstrated that patients have quite a bit of improvement in their symptoms and a decrease in the volume of fibroids after 15 months with respect to, you know, 15% or 13% decrease in volume size. Sometimes the amount that it shrinks doesn't necessarily matter. It's really the fact that it's no longer alive and it's no longer hormonally active that can really help a patient. Some of the side effects, well, as we're doing the procedure, there's quite a bit of cramping and pain, which is why we give moderate sedation. That can cause some nausea and vomiting for the patients, and they can feel some generalized discomfort and may have some vaginal discharge. During the actual procedure, what we do is we give them a panic button. And if she feels that she has skin burning, she presses it and it stops what I'm doing, and then we go and address the skin burning. She also presses it when she has pain going down her leg, because that's a signal that we're injuring some nerves, and as a result, we want to avoid peripheral nerve injury. So the really, really bad complications, really, it's injury to the intestines. So sometimes you can get fooled and a loop of bowel can be hiding somewhere. And if you're not real careful, you can burn through it. And that's just pretty bad, bad complication for the patient, because it requires surgery and other morbidities. The alternative therapy to MR-guided focus ultrasound, I'll briefly go over, is uterine artery embolization, which is one of my favorite procedures. This is a minimally invasive therapy. The other ones we've been talking about are pretty non-invasive when it comes to HIFU. But in this case, you actually have to enter the blood vessels in the patient. And in order to enter the blood vessel, you have to put a needle into an artery. And as a result, it's minimally invasive. Here, what we do is we identify the arteries that supply the fibroid by doing a pelvic arteriogram, and that's a word where we identify the abdominal aorta and find the arteries that go to the uterus. And once we are in the arteries that go to the uterus, we identify the branches that supply the fibroid, and again, we do this procedure under moderate sedation so the patient doesn't feel much discomfort. In this case, though, it's not an outpatient procedure. It's minimally invasive, and it requires a one-night hospitalization, mainly for pain control. So here, this is an abdominal or a pelvic angiogram. So this is the abdominal aorta, the largest artery in your body directly coming off the heart, and it divides into the right side and the left side, go into your pelvis and then down your leg. And we identify this. This is the uterine artery. It has a very classic tortuous course. And this here is the uterus, which is essentially all fibroid. And you can see this very vascular ball. And what we do is we embolize, or we block off the blood vessels to the fibroid systematically. So we first address the left side, and we see get into this artery. You see all these. It looks like a tree, right? Arborization. And we inject these little tiny beads that clog up the artery that predominantly goes to the fibroid, and we do it on the other side. And then after we're done, we do another angiogram. We do another evaluation of the arteries, and you don't see that big ball in the middle anymore. And so how does this work? Well, what we see here is the uterus that has, I don't know why this one isn't showing, but has decreased in size. And you can see that the change from baseline to 3 months is really consistent after 1 year. So what I always tell my patients is, listen, it's going to take 3 months for you to feel better, for the uterus and for the fibroids to shrink, but it's going to last for a very, very long time. How effective is it? Pretty amazing, actually. So if the symptoms are abnormal bleeding, then the procedure is effective for greater than 90% of the patients. If it's the bulk symptoms, the pressure and the pain, it can still be very effective, but it's slightly less than for bleeding. What are the complications? Well, sometimes very few patients can actually experience absent periods, and that's the word transient amenorrhea, which means you just don't have your periods for a little bit, and then they come back. Some people talk about permanent amenorrhea or potentially going into menopause, and that's really age dependent. If you're a female younger than the age of 45, the chances of you developing menopause after this procedure is really less than 3 or 5%. If you're greater than 45, then it may, for whatever reason, whether it's communication between the arteries of the fibroid and the uterus, kind of push you towards menopause. And the rest of the complications, such as developing blood clots or infections, or having a little bits of the fibroid that get passed through the uterus into the vagina, are actually quite low. So here's another example of a patient who had a very large fibroid. She had pelvic pressure, and after her uterine artery embolization, you can see that again the entire uterus is beautifully enhancing. It's bright, and the center, which is the fibroid, is completely dead. Another example of a fibroid here after uterine artery embolization, the uterus gets bright, but the fibroid dies. So it's a pretty cool, interesting, and helpful procedure. So at this point, I'd like to pause and ask Dr. Lager to talk about a really cool technique that they're using in gynecology, very similar to what we do with other organs to kill fibroids.
So this procedure is almost a hybrid of what Dr. Zagori was talking about in a minimally invasive surgical procedure. It was FDA approved in 2012 and is an outpatient surgical procedure that's done in the operating room under general anesthesia. It is a uterine-sparing procedure, meaning that the treatment only affects the fibroid, leaving the uterus in place, and it has very minimal blood loss. It's usually less than 4 ounces of blood, so very low. This is the device. The device is a 3-millimeter handheld surgical probe with a deployable needle electrode array, so it releases 7 tines into the fibroid. It has connected to a radio frequency generator and has a foot pedal to turn it on. And then there are 2 side-by-side video images. There are 2 ports that are placed. One is a laparoscopic camera to look at the fibroid from inside the abdominal cavity, and then the other is a laparoscopic ultrasound transducer. So it's an ultrasound that actually is right up against the fibroid to be able to look at the fibroid. And you can see the image on the left side is the ultrasound image of the fibroid, and the image on the right side is the laparoscopic image. With radio frequency ablation, what we do is we identify the fibroid with the ultrasound. The radio frequency probe is then deployed, and the needle tines are inserted into the location of the fibroid. and it heats up to 100 degrees Celsius, and the fibroid becomes destroyed or coagulative necrosis occurs. There aren't many studies on this. The largest study is with Dr. Chudnoff and his colleagues. 135 women were in the study. They were followed at 3, 6, and 12 months. And they found that over the course of time that the uterine fibroid decreased in volume by 45% and vaginal bleeding decreased in 35%. They also had the patients fill out questionnaires for fibroid symptoms and for quality of life. And they found that the fibroid symptoms decreased and the quality of life increased. There were very few adverse events. One adverse event was a readmission for infection, but otherwise they were very minor adverse events. And there was a rate of reoperation of less than 1%, so one person had a treatment failure and needed a different procedure. That same group followed up in 3 years, and so this was by Dr. Berman et al., and they followed him up over 3 years. They sent out the same questionnaires, the uterine fibroid severity questionnaire on quality of life, and they found that they had improvement in their quality of life, decrease in their symptoms, and the overall surgical reintervention rate was 11 out of 135, or 8%, which is pretty equal to other uterine-sparing procedures. There are ongoing studies for radiofrequency ablation. There are two that are being done by one of my wonderful colleagues, Dr. Vanessa Jacoby, and one is the ULTRA Registry. So it's a nationwide collection of patients who are undergoing radiofrequency ablation and women that are over 21 to try to collect information about their symptoms, need for reoperation, and pregnancy outcomes. At this point, we don't recommend this procedure for pregnancy because we don't have a lot of information about that, but we're collecting that data. And then also there's a UC-wide ULTRA trial, which is among five hospitals that are for women that are undergoing radiofrequency ablation. And it is at UCSF, UC Davis, UC Irvine, UCLA, and UC San Diego.
So thank you. So in summary, I hope you guys have realized that uterine fibroids are extremely common, and there are a number of minimally invasive or rather non-invasive surgical and radiologic options. So there's MR-guided focused ultrasound, which is completely non-invasive, outpatient, and the outcomes really depend on the fibroid characteristics and how much of the fibroid you were able to burn. Uterine artery embolization, which is minimally invasive therapy, does require a one-night stay, but has the ability of treating all of the fibroids, and a radiofrequency ablation, which is a little bit more invasive, but still outpatient and the new kid on the block. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll all stand here and entertain your questions.
Oh, so I'm going to repeat the question. And the one question was the idea of improving care for many patients would be collaborative efforts. And then also who does the patient kind of belong to when we see them in our clinic. So we're not primary care doctors, the second question. But patients are generally referred to us by other physicians after they've discussed options with the patient. So you have a uterine fibroid, you have a kidney tumor, you have a bone tumor. You'll go see an orthopedic surgeon who might say, well, we could operate on this, but we've got this other option for you. And we generally know about those other options, like surgery as well, and we'll discuss those with the patient. In terms of collaborating, it's not that easy. I mean, it's the world, the United States, even a sophisticated country like this, is complicated. If you're a small rural community, your doctors may have different levels of information. If you come to a medical center like UCSF, you're assured you're going to get the latest and the greatest and access to these multidisciplinary groups where we all participate in those. We do that many hours every week where we meet with other specialists and we're presenting our part of the puzzle. They're presenting their solutions and their part of the puzzle.
I would say that's one of my favorite parts of being part of the Comprehensive Fibroid Center is that oftentimes we'll look at images together, or we'll discuss it as a group with my colleagues, too, to try to figure out what the best solution is or the best treatment for each individual patient. So it's great. Yeah. So the question is that we didn't mention hysterectomy much in this discussion, and that in the past that the recommendations for treatment have been expectant management, waiting till someone goes into menopause, versus hysterectomy. And at what point do we decide that someone would need a hysterectomy, or when would we recommend it, and would we recommend these other options? Does that sound about right? And so I would say that we did mention it once, but you're right. When we see patients in the fibroid center, we always talk about different options. I think in the past, we used to say if someone was done with childbearing that we would and they had symptomatic fibroids, that we would recommend a hysterectomy. And now we look at that differently because, for example, if someone has just heavy bleeding and they have a submucosal fibroid, we can do a simple procedure like a hysteroscopic myomectomy, that they don't have any incisions, they go home the same day. So I think that the important part is to offer people different options. And as you heard about the UAE and MRI-focused ultrasound, they recover so much quicker with those procedures. And so sometimes that's a better option for them. And so in general, we try to offer them a whole mix of different options. The ones that are ones that I would recommend for hysterectomy, the fibroids that I see, are for patients that have maybe very, very large fibroids. So sometimes fibroids can be the size of, you know, an 8-month pregnancy or a 7-month pregnancy above the belly button. And those aren't always good fibroids that would be treated with MRI-focused ultrasound. So that's one group. And then the other group is, you know, it's very rare, but about less than 1 in 350 can sometimes be associated with cancer fibroids. And so if there are any reasons that would be more suspicious that we would be concerned about cancer, then we would recommend hysterectomy.
So what proportion of women still get a hysterectomy? And it used to be huge. It was like a third of all women, right?
Yeah.
In this country, something like that. And now it must be much less than that.
Yeah, it's much less. It used to be the leading surgery for women. Now it's, I think it's a C-section is number one, but it's exactly. But it is going down, which is very important. But I can't tell you what the number is. I don't know offhand.
But I think the main reason is that we have times have changed, and patients are a lot more enabled and a lot more educated, and they research therapies and options. They know more about something sometimes before I even start talking about it. And so, and women, you know, the perception of women and the control they have on their health and their body has changed. And, you know, a 40-year-old or a 46-year-old woman should not be forced into a hysterectomy because she has a small fibroid, which unfortunately does still happen in this country. But she should at least be given the discussion of all the other therapies that are equally effective, much less morbid, and less costly. So what I find is a lot of patients who may have been told that they need a hysterectomy or they must have a hysterectomy, and they come and they seek alternative therapies, and they find us, and they go to the UCSF Comprehensive Fibroid Center, and they see a gynecologist, and they realize that they could have their fibroids ablated, or they could have just their fibroid removed and preserve their uterus and preserve their fertility. So I think with just change in time and outreach and education that we're making this change and decreasing the rate of hysterectomy. Yes.
So question one was an engine that generates pain within the body. What is that? Sorry, that's me trying to be a little bit too poetic, I think. That was a description of the osteodysteoma, the center of the tumor we call a nidus, and that nidus is what is creating hormones that generate pain. And then the third? Sound that burns. Right. So the basis for the technology is that we're generating sound waves from the device, and we're using very high energy sound waves and focusing them at a single point. And so when we focus all that energy at a single point, it raises the temperature eventually to a temperature where it can burn the tissue.
Thank you. And number two was
piezoelectric.
Oh, yeah.
That's just the components of it. Piezoelectric crystals are a component of the ultrasound probe. So all ultrasound technology relies on these crystals that can focus the sound, grab the sound that bounces back from the patient's body and give us a picture. So a sound wave goes out into the body, passes through certain things, and then gets an image essentially and comes back and registers that. And those are the crystals that allow for that technology.
So the questions about radiation exposure using the CT scanner for guidance when we do the kidney tumor ablations. And we were standing there, and the scanner, we focus on just a very tiny bit of the body. We know first we get a scan, and we know where the tumor is, and then we're working all within, you know, a centimeter or so, so we only scan that part. We use a combination of very low-dose radiation and very short exposures. So it's we've measured all that, and it's a minuscule, basically insignificant amount of radiation. And the kind of damage that you would get from these radiation doses would require much larger doses, plus it wouldn't take effect for 20 years or so if you were to develop any kind of secondary cancer. But we really don't use that kind of doses.
Is that done under anesthesia, local?
It's done. The question was, is it done under anesthesia, local? It's a very. You can't do it under just local, although we often use local to augment other sedation. You can do it with conscious sedation, but it is, again, a little bit painful. We usually do it under general anesthesia, so it's a short procedure. It takes about an hour of actual time from when we start the ablation. And it's a short time. The general anesthesia, the patient feels no pain. It's very safe in skilled hands. It's as safe as conscious sedation. With the patient laying on their stomach, we worry a little bit about their airway, that if there were a problem, it would be hard to get to that. And we can control your breathing. So, again, the kidney moves when you breathe quite a bit. And so we want it to be in one spot. So we can hold the breath for a moment while we advance the probe and then start breathing again. So it helps us make the procedure go quicker. Yes.
Why do you use CT in one case and MRI in others? I don't understand.
Well, CT is very effective for seeing kidney tumors, and we don't need to have those temperature-sensitive measures because I've got the probe in the body and also has a little thermometer built into it, so I can know what the temperature is that I'm generating. The images are very accurate for the things that I need to see, the intestines, the ureter, which is the tiny tube that goes from your kidney to your bladder, which could be a little bit harder to see with MR. Plus, the time on the scanner is much less limited for CT than MR. We have a lot of CT scanners. We have pretty many MR scanners. But the time on it, it works real quickly with CT. We've got a lot of scanners. You can run patients through them diagnostically quickly. So if I tie it up for an hour, that's okay. Whereas MR, the time and expense is much greater. And there really is no benefit to using MR for what I do. What they do when they're working completely outside the body and where these tumors are not like hanging off the organ necessarily like mine are, I think it's easier probably to visualize them with MR. And they have the temperature thing. Yes.
So I think the question was about the advances that are done in technology and the sort of what that means with respect to medicine and diagnosis of tumors. So I think you can get a whole body CT or a PET CT or an MRI now. You know, I think it's just when people were building their own CT scanners back in the day, there were, you know, pamphlets given out and signs on the freeway of get a whole body CT. I think that imaging has become an integral part of medicine. It is now back in the old days, even when I was going to medical school, there's a lot of reliance on physical exams and trying to diagnose what's wrong with the patient based on the history and the labs. And now you have this sort of look inside a patient's body. And so I think a lot of referring physicians, a lot of primary care physicians want to see what's going on, whether it's with an ultrasound or a CT or an MRI. We're at the forefront of that. We're having more and more stronger and stronger magnets on a yearly basis, newer technology, combination of different technology. There is PET CT, which most of us, I imagine, are familiar with. We have PET MRI. So I don't know when we're going to be Star Wars. I kind of feel like I am, you know, Leia, better hair. But I think we're on our way. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, I would comment. I think one of the things is scanning is already Star Trek-like, but one thing we've learned is it's very sensitive, but it's not all that specific. We can find many abnormalities, but it's sort of like driving, you know, my older car. I hear a rattle, and I might want to track down what's causing that rattle, but if I try to fix that, something else is going to break and things go downhill. And we can find lots of things, but what we've learned is not every cancer is one that we have to worry about. Not every tumor is a cancer. Not every lump or bump we see is concerning. And if you chase every one of those, it'll be a problem. So I think the next thing that we're going to see is learning more specific findings, like the PET MR is a good example. It's a functional test fused with anatomy, because many of the tumors that I see that I treat, would they be life-threatening? I don't really know. A 2-centimeter kidney tumor, it's easy to kill that. There's a tiny risk with it, but did I need to do that? Don't know. But I think we're developing genetic tools and new ways of testing these tumors to see, is that a bad one? Or maybe one that I don't have to worry about. Yes?
Yes, you said in the first talk that to find small kidney tumors, you needed to use, could only be found in a scan. So how does one know or go about getting a scan? What triggers a scan?
Well, people that I see, they've been scanned for things like diverticulitis or appendicitis or, again, abdominal pain. They went to the emergency room. We found the tumor incidentally. You did one of the, if you went to Judy Yee's session on CT colonography because you were 50 years old and you needed to get your colon checked, that's why. But otherwise, you know, you wouldn't know. And the truth is that most of those tumors will never bother you. They're like prostate cancer that we've learned that initially all of those got treated, but they were much overtreated. There were many treatments that caused harm and didn't benefit the patient. It's much the same way with these kidney tumors and other kinds of tumors. That's what we have to learn. But there are no symptoms with most of these small kidney tumors. You would never know they had them unless we stumbled upon it when they were looking at your gallbladder, for instance. It's just by chance. Incidental finding, we call that. Yes. The question was, we have mentioned breast cancer. Some people have experimented with doing ablations for breast cancer. You have to realize the organs I work with, liver, kidney, pancreas, those are deep inside you. The treatment of those requires a big operation. The breast, although it's a major operation, it's a very superficial organ. You can take out the tumor relatively easy, even with local anesthesia in some cases. It's much easier to approach, plus you can be sure you got the whole tumor there with surgery. With what we're doing, we're only looking at images, and it'll be easy to contemplate that we left some microscopic disease in there, and we don't know about it until it's spread. It's one of the tumors that also can spread pretty early. I don't know. Are there other?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the only other thing that I'd add is that the breast is, when you think of kidneys and you think of the fibroids being near the bowel, then the breasts are not near any other organs, so there's less risk in surgically removing it without worrying about coming close to other organs that are nearby that could inadvertently be damaged as well.
But thank you all for coming, and it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.